Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, the Tea Party shuts down the government over the Affordable Care Act, which is so unpopular it draws millions to shop for health insurance on its first day.
Sky-high premiums once forced Nancy Beagle to choose between paying her rent or paying for health insurance. She's been uninsured ever since.
But now?
Nancy can get covered just like everybody else.
President Obama on fire in the Rose Garden yesterday. Later this hour, we will hear a more extended excerpt from that speech and meet four listeners from New York and New Jersey who are shopping for insurance on the new exchanges already and see what their stories and their experiences have been like so far. We'll also talk about terrorism as an issue in the New York City mayoral race today in our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series. And we have Malcolm Gladwell on the program today to talk about his new book, David and Goliath, and take your calls on his amazing body of work, Malcolm Gladwell, today. But we begin with another very special guest, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who served as the last Labour Party Prime Minister from 2007 to 2010. He is now the UN Special Envoy for Global Education in New York for the General Assembly in that context, working with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the goal of educating all the world's children, including the hundreds of thousands of refugee kids from the Syrian civil war. We'll talk about that, maybe get his take on some of the government dysfunction taking place on this side of the pond, if for a little laugh, if nothing else, and more. Mr. Brown, it is an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
A great pleasure to be here.
Can we start with your meeting with Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani girl who was shot by the Taliban on a school bus last year? I gather you and she joined forces to make an announcement here in New York last week. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've known Malala since she was injured, and I went to Pakistan almost immediately after the attempted assassination. She came, as you know, to the United Kingdom, where she's getting medical treatment, and she's now at school with us in the United Kingdom. So she and I were in New York for last week, meeting the Secretary General and other people. And one of the things that we were talking about was the 1 million refugees from Syria. This is the worst humanitarian catastrophe this century. Children are the people who are worst off as a result of a tragedy like this. They lose food, shelter, health care, but they also lose the chance of their childhood through education. And to a large extent, they lose hope. So we want to do something about it. And it so happens there is a way forward that Malala and I are supporting, which is there are about 400,000 Syrian children who are going to be in Lebanon by the end of the year. Most of them are there already. They could go to school in Lebanon if we could organize to do double shifts in Lebanese schools. We've got a proposal that we've made. People have been in Lebanon to work it through. We've talked to the Lebanese government. It seems like something that could be done that would be inexpensive but very cost-effective, because it would get the kids to school, get them meals at school. It would mean that the refugee status was still, of course, they were refugees, but they were being given the chance of an education, and they could be there for years. So we've got this plan. It's been put to all the international agencies. It's now being investigated in more detail, but I hope it could be up and running in a few weeks. And I hope also that the international agencies, USAID, the UK agency, and other agencies will be prepared to support it financially. We reckon it will cost about $175 million a year to do this, but we reckon that for 400,000 children to get their education and to have some hope about the future, it is money well spent.
So are you asking the U.S. and other governments to contribute to that fund? Is that an obstacle?
Yeah, I've been talking to the U.S. You've got a very brilliant head of USAID, Raj Shah, and I've talked to the other agencies, the British one, the European ones, Norway, Denmark. We've talked to some of the Arab countries, Qatar and UAE and Saudi, and about what they can do to help. And there is a principle.
Commitments, financial commitments?
Yeah, yeah. And they will make financial commitments. I'm absolutely sure of that once the plan is up and running. But what we're trying to establish is something really quite important. If you are going to help refugees or people who are displaced as a result of conflict, who are children, then you've got to offer something more than just saying we'll give you a tent or give you a camp. The average refugee sort of period of time out of their own country is about 10 years. So if you leave your country, it's very difficult to get back for years. And so children could lose their whole childhood. So I want to establish the principle that there is a right to education irrespective of borders, irrespective of whether your country is a broken down regime or not. We did establish it for health with the Red Cross and Médecins Sans Frontières, that there is a right to health care in situations where there are conflicts and broken down regimes, but we haven't yet established it for children's rights to education.
It's
and I think most people would want to see that happen. It actually costs, we've worked out, $1 a day for these children to get educated, and that is money well spent.
It's an incredibly important and worthwhile goal, and I'm so glad you're here talking about it today. You mentioned the 400,000 children in refugee camps in Lebanon. All the children from the Syria crisis who are refugees are spread out into a number of different countries that are housing the camps. Do you have different obstacles in different countries?
Well, interestingly enough, Lebanon does not have camps as such. The children are dispersed across the country because the Lebanese have been very adamant that they don't want to see the setting up of camps. So people are staying in settlements in Crampton, in sort of small rented flats and everything else. So we don't have the problem of camps, but we do have that in Jordan. And so a lot is to be done on Jordan. And I was talking to Queen Rani of Jordan about it when she was at the United Nations this week. She is very keen to get a solution to that problem in Jordan. I've also talked to the Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey, whom I met, because there are refugees not only within Turkey, and Turkey is doing its best to help them, but the refugees on the Turkish border, and they are still in Syria. They're in danger, of course, but they are not getting proper services, and we should be able to do something about refugees who are displaced even within their own country. They've been moved from the cities to these rural areas. They're on the edge of the borders, but they're not safe, and we need to do something about that.
Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is my guest on WNYC in his role now as the UN Special Envoy for Global Education. We can take your phone calls from Mr. Brown at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Malala's story, as you know, included the obstacle that the Taliban actually did not want her or other girls to learn as a matter of ideology. Is that an issue at all with the Syrian refugees, or is it all about the logistics of getting kids educated in these difficult circumstances?
No, there are extremist groups who want to stop children being educated. Last weekend in Nigeria, Boko Haram, which is the terrorist group there, and their name literally translated means Western education is a sin. They want to stop children being educated there. And tragically, 50 children were gunned to death in the college in which they were resident on Sunday in Nigeria. And, of course, not only in Pakistan, but in parts of Africa and in parts of the Middle East, there is this religious extremist view that girls particularly should not be educated. That's why in a week's time, International Girls' Day is going to be incredibly important. And there's going to be events around the world, I think 150 separate events by Girls Rising. And really what we're talking about is the civil rights struggle of our generation, that girls should have a right to education. They're being denied it. Some of them are being denied it just simply because of discrimination against girls, like what happened with Malala. Some are being pushed into child marriage. We have this tragic case of an 8-year-old girl in Yemen who was married off at 8 and died because of the brutalization of her by her husband. And that is now leading to a campaign within Yemen to make sure that there is no early marriage, and teenage marriages until the age of 18 are banned. And we have, of course, child labour. And child labour, girls and boys who are dragged into being domestic servants or working down mines. Again, this is discrimination, and this is something that is intolerable in the 21st century. So a girl's right to education, I compare it to your civil rights struggles in America in the 1960s, where one part of the community was denied basic rights. This is girls in a number of countries, because of an extreme interpretation of a particular religious ideology, who are denied any right to education, married off against their will, forced into child labour, or simply banned from going to school. And Malala, by standing up for girls' right to education, when she was, of course, cruelly shot as a result of that, she inspired a whole generation of girls in Pakistan. Because when I visited Pakistan only a few days after she was shot, the girls were wearing headbands, "I am Malala," which was girls in record numbers standing up against the Taliban's desire to ban girls from going to school. So this is a problem not just in Pakistan, it's a problem across part of the Middle East, and of course it's a problem in Africa, as we saw with this terrible tragedy last weekend.
It's a civil rights struggle, and it's also an anti-poverty struggle. Last week, one of our guests was Assistant Secretary General John Hendra, working to educate all girls as part of the UN's Millennium Development Goals of ending extreme poverty. Which is the bigger obstacle to that education? Is it ideological resistance, as with the Taliban, or is it economic pressure in the poorest regions of the world?
I think both of these things are important, but remember there's another issue, the absence of teachers, the lack of schools, the lack of classrooms. And our organization, which is working through the United Nations World at School, we're, in a sense, an umbrella organization for all those who are campaigning against child labor, against child marriage, against girl trafficking, against discrimination against girls, but also saying we've got to move people from exploitation into education. We've got to get people out of oppression and give them opportunity. Slavery is a problem in the modern world, but young girls particularly, but boys and girls should be at school. And we need, therefore, 2 million more teachers. We need 4 million more classrooms. We need the right of a child to be educated, to be established in countries where, for example, in Pakistan, 7 million boys and girls are not going to school. Nigeria, 10 million girls and boys not going to school. Afghanistan, 4 million girls and boys not going to school. Yemen, Ethiopia, go through the world, India, and you'll find that there are 57 million girls and boys who this morning cannot go to school because there is no school for them that is available. And we've got to do something about that. And if I'm right, that young people themselves, this is the thing that's changed over the last year, partly as a result of Malala's brave stand against the Taliban. Girls and boys are not prepared to accept any longer that they should be denied these rights. And we see something of an Arab Spring in the attitude of young people in Asia and Africa demanding their right to education and saying, why can't we go to school? Why are we being denied the right to go to school? And although in the West, we take it for granted, and of course it's boring for some young people to think they've got to go to school every day. These children are fighting for a basic right. They are demanding that they go to school, and I think that is the biggest change in the last year, that instead of education just being a technical issue, how can we get girls and boys to go to school, young people themselves are saying it's a matter of our right, and it's the dignity of our us as boys and girls that is going to have to be met, and we want to go to school.
Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown with us in the studio in his role as the special UN envoy for global education now. Mr. Brown, why don't you put on your headphones over there, and we're going to take a few phone calls on this. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Tell me if you have any trouble with those and if the volume is set all right once we put Lisa in Harlem on the air with you. Lisa, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Some of your listeners probably know who I am. I have been around the city with my companion calling out to get people to sign a petition to President Obama against negotiating with the Taliban. We've got Malala's picture there, and we are telling people that we consider this just like Neville Chamberlain's mistake. We consider these people barbarians, completely unreliable, both morally and politically. And people, of course, have asked what the alternative is. Before I go,
you need to be very brief, so please go there right now, because you need to be brief, so go there right now.
Could you please ask Mr. Brown, and I'm thrilled to be hearing him on the air, if he agrees that the United States should not negotiate with the Taliban? I'll hang up and get his answer.
Thank you for your call.
Remember, I'm talking not just about the Taliban here. I'm talking about all extremist sects, and they're existing in Africa as well as in the Middle East, who are denying the right of girls the chance of education. And it is an attitudinal change, a cultural change that's got to happen within these organizations over a period of time. And I think by standing up for the right of girls to get education, of course, there was a huge outcry when a Taliban leader said that Malala could go to school, but only as long as she went to madrasas, and she should never be involved in going to a school which was teaching things other than a dogmatic view of what the Muslim religion was.
So in the context of Afghanistan,
my view is that we've got to send a message right across the world that any extremist sect that is saying to people that girls have got no rights has got to be challenged. And it's not a question of me getting involved in the diplomatic work that the American government's going to make a decision about what it does. It's a question of me saying that we will not tolerate any extremist sect saying to girls that they've got no right to go to school.
But you're not going to take a position on whether it furthers that goal or sets up another obstacle to it for there to be some kind of negotiated government that includes the Taliban in
Afghanistan? I've made it absolutely clear that if you're talking to anybody, it's got to be absolutely clear that there is no question of us ever agreeing that girls should not have the right to go to school. And so this is, for me, a bottom line, that you cannot go around the world denying these basic human rights.
Tedla in Flushing, originally from Ethiopia, right, Tedla?
Yes, Brian. Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning. Thank you
for
coming on.
I really applaud you for your this global education campaign. But let me be honest with you and ask you a simple question. I'm from Ethiopia. There are now many young Ethiopians going back to school in the last 2 decades. That is on the record. But the problem is that if you go to a higher level, junior high school, high school, the kids, they don't have anything. There is no enough teachers. There is no enough books. There is nothing. If you go to university, I know people who graduate from university who cannot write a good paragraph. So we are bringing illiterate people in this world. And then what will happen? There is no job. And what will be the interest of educating people where they end up being illiterate in the final conclusion?
So, Tedla, is your point that it drains resources from higher education to have a goal of universal primary education?
Well, that may be part of it. The question is, where is the incentive for the kids to go to school if they see their brothers, older brothers, going to college and have nothing? They are not educated after all. So we are
I've been in Ethiopia, and I've seen at first hand huge advances, of course, because there are millions more girls and boys going to school. There's a huge amount to be done in the rural areas. And before he died, President Meles and I had worked out a plan where we could get education for the rural children of Ethiopia as well. But you're absolutely right. I visited a number of blind children who were at a school in Addis Ababa, and it was tragic to see the fact that they didn't even have access to basic Braille. They didn't have computers that could actually help them. You know, there is huge technology available now where you can transfer print into audio immediately, and so that blind child could have access to the most basic of materials that would allow them to join in the education lessons with other children. So there's a lack of basic materials for blind children, but also for higher education, further education, and secondary education. And the answer is we've got to invest more in education. We've got to start recognizing that the future of the world and the future of individual countries depends on them having educated and skilled people. And we've also got to recognize, as the World at School campaign is saying, that if you can get children education, then particularly for girls, it helps with health because they've got knowledge and information. It avoids AIDS. It avoids infant mortality. It stops early marriages. It stops the spread of diseases. It gives children and girls particularly information about when they start a family. That means that less infant mortality results. In many countries, the rate of infant mortality is half for those girls who are educated against those who are not. So I would say countries like Ethiopia, but other countries, cannot afford not to invest in education. And our job is to persuade them that instead of spending money on other things, on wasteful projects, prestige projects, projects that actually don't make a huge difference to the country's future, the best investment a country can make is in education. And we in the international community must be prepared to give more resources to these countries that are prepared to invest more in their education and give that as an incentive for them to actually extend primary education to secondary and to tertiary education. And I tell you this, children and young people around the world know now why some children have got opportunities and others don't. They're connected by mobile phones and by a level of information on the internet that has never before been available to children, particularly in poor countries. And they will soon realize that they're being denied opportunities that other people are getting. And so we've got a ticking time bomb here that young people who are being denied opportunity are going to fight back at some point. And we've got a duty to recognize that they too have rights to education, even in the poorest and least promising countries of the world.
Another listener who says he's from Pakistan originally sends in a historical critique, which is that English imperialism destroyed education throughout the Middle East and Africa. Do you acknowledge a historical contribution to the problem?
Well, I think you could have an argument about what happened 100 years ago and what happened 50 years ago, but we're actually in the 21st century now. And the issue is, why are countries that have been independent for years not able to deliver basic primary education to the children? And there is no justification for denying children this basic right to education. It's not actually so costly. I gave the figure as $1 a day for children in Syria who are now in Lebanon to get education. In Africa, the cost of educating a child is about $100 a year. Now, I can't think of a parent that I would meet here in America or in Britain or across Europe that would say they should deny a child an education at $100 a year. And really, in the 21st century, we've got to do better. It's all very well talking about the past. We've got to think about here and now. Why cannot we deliver something as... You don't need a scientific breakthrough. You don't need a medical invention. You don't need some new technological sort of genius to deliver education. It's a simple thing about getting good teachers and getting books and getting classrooms. And surely, in every country in the world, it's possible to do that in the 21st century. And that's the message of the World at School. And it'll be the message, by the way, on International Girls' Day, when everybody will be saying across the world, it's time for every girl to have the chance of education.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, now the UN Special Envoy for Global Education in New York for the General Assembly, working with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on this. Could the agreement with Syria on chemical weapons actually work against the interests of the refugee kids you're hoping to educate if all we're enforcing is the surrender of chemical weapons and in effect doing business with Assad? Does that lengthen his time in power, which lengthens the displacement of the refugees and the difficulty of kids still in Syria from getting educated?
Look, whatever happens now, whether Assad is in power or not, whether there's an agreement on chemical weapons or not, there is a humanitarian crisis. That crisis is going to go on for years. You cannot wish it away by a simple agreement. You've got to work at getting those young people, those children and adults who are refugees, opportunities that they can actually make the most of their time now that they're out of the country or displaced within the country. We have done a huge amount of fundraising in the last few weeks, and it's really interesting because people talk about aid fatigue and about how people are fed up having to give money to good causes. Avaaz, this great social networking, website, it raised $1 million in a few days from young people to put to the education of Syrian refugee children. Western Union, the company that has 500,000 offices around the world, is opening every one of their offices asking people to donate to these Syrian refugee children to give them an education. And I think we'll prove over the next few weeks that people want to help these children who are in the direst of straits. And I've talked to some of these girls and boys who've been displaced from Syria. Some had saw their school bombed. Some had to hide under the school or in a way that they had to escape by stealth from the area in which they were in, and now are living in terrible conditions in other countries. We've got to do something about it.
When you stepped down as Prime Minister in 2010, you kept your seat in Parliament. Are you still in Parliament in addition to your other work?
Yes, I'm the Member of Parliament for the constituency in which I grew up and was at school and was have my friends and where I actually stay. I don't stay in London. I stay in that constituency, Kirkcaldy and Cowdenbeath, and it's a privilege to represent people that you were at school with and people who were who know you and where you've lived all your life.
So may I ask how you voted on the resolution to support the U.S. in military action in Syria that was so shockingly defeated and that really led to the current round of diplomacy and the chemical weapons agreement?
I was doing work on my global education. I wasn't in London at
how
the time.
How would you have voted?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, we need some pretty profound thinking about this. What is a just war? What is a just intervention? And I think it's pretty clear that if you look at what the case was that President Obama put, there was a just cause. There's no doubt about it. Chemical weapons are an abomination. And for 100 years, we've tried to ban chemical weapons. Was there good intentions, which is the other criteria for a just war? I think people did not want to use action against chemical weapons as an excuse for something else. Was the action going to be proportionate? President Obama always said it would be proportionate. The other issues that I think still had to be dealt with, and this is where the questions arose, I think, amongst the general public, would the gain from taking action be greater than any cost of taking action? Would the benefits exceed the costs that were involved, and I think the public were waiting to be assured about some of these issues. So I can understand why there was some doubt about this in the public's mind, but it's pretty clear to me there was a just cause, there were good intentions, action would have been proportionate. And I think they met the criteria for a just intervention.
So you would have tended to support the United States, it says. So,
well, I hope there's an agreement now on the elimination of chemical weapons in Syria. But, you know, I have to concentrate my efforts where I can make the biggest impact. And rather than me trying to to second-guess President Obama or second-guess the British government, I prefer to say, look, whatever happens, whatever the negotiations lead to, you have still got this humanitarian disaster. And I think I can do more by concentrating on persuading people, irrespective of what view they took on military intervention, that they should do something to help those people who are in a humanitarian crisis.
One more thing on this, though. What do you say to those critics who say the British Parliament displayed a new British weakness and then that generalized to the United States when Obama went to Congress, a Western weakness that will leave us all more vulnerable to the aggressors and the rogue leaders of the world?
Well, I think you've got to put it in its context that America and the West, with a few exceptions, has been engaged in military actions in Iraq and then in Afghanistan over recent years. It has not been the case that over the last 20 years people have not been prepared to intervene. In fact, some would argue that we've been intervening a great deal. And it's hardly surprising there's a degree of war weariness and people are asking what is the purpose of these interventions. So you've got to put it in its proper context. But do I believe we have a responsibility to protect people in circumstances where they cannot protect themselves and where they're living under an authoritarian or totalitarian regime that is practicing violence and in some cases genocide against the population? Of course I believe that we've got a responsibility to protect. And I think the world looked at Rwanda and saw that 1 million people died in a few weeks and we did nothing and felt that we had to say that there is a responsibility to protect.
Now, before you go, you happen to be in the States at a time when our government is making headlines for shutting down and putting its worst dysfunction on display for all the world to see. How does it look to you?
Well, you know, I can look out the window in New York and see the Statue of Liberty and then know that I can't visit it. Because it's closed down. And I think it will surprise people to find that things are closed down as a result of this decision. But I'm so used to the day-to-day maneuvers, intricacies, details of politics. I think the public also feel the same way, that this is something that will come and it will go and it may not make a huge amount of difference.
Does the UK have any parallel examples of government shutdowns or parliamentary gridlock, or is there something in your system that actually makes it harder to reach this point?
I think in the 1970s we had what was called the three-day week, when because of a power shortages and because of a strike of coal miners, people were only able to work 3 days a week instead of 5 days a week. Some people said there was higher productivity because it was only 3 days rather than 5 days. But I think the nearest parallel is the three-day week.
And last thing, at the heart of the debate here is the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And critics of it on the right say we don't want to be like Britain with its low-quality health service that some people use. Do you think there are any lessons from the UK's experience with aiming for universal coverage that Americans can learn from one way or another?
Well, I'm always surprised at the American writing and media coverage of the British National Health Service, because in Britain, the health service is the most popular of institutions. It is not reviled or attacked or caricatured as being some totalitarian imposition. It is basically a right of every single citizen, irrespective of money, irrespective of their wealth or income, to have their health care provided on the basis of their need. And to many, when it was introduced in the 1940s, it was a deliverance from pain, suffering, an inability to get the health care you needed when you needed it. And I think if people came to Britain, they would find that the nurses, the doctors, the staff who make up the National Health Service are held in the highest of regard and the highest of esteem. And I think there's a basic principle that healthcare is allocated and available according to the need of the individual.
Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, now the UN Special Envoy for Global Education in New York for the General Assembly, working with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the worthy and vital goal of educating all the world's children, including the hundreds of thousands of refugee kids from the Syrian civil war. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we will play an excerpt from President Obama's speech in the Rose Garden yesterday about Obamacare and the shutdown. And then we will meet four listeners from New York and New Jersey who are shopping for insurance on the new exchanges already and see what their stories and their experiences have been like so far. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.